The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah fighters take full control of the Al Juba Directorate, the last area south of the strategic city of Marib. At least 7 people are killed and scores more injured as protests continue in Sudan against the Monday military coup d'etat. Plus, in Iran, the number of COVID deaths and infections shows a continued downward trend amid a widespread vaccination campaign. Hi everyone, I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah fighters are inching closer to southern oil-rich Marib province to fully liberate it from Saudi and UAE-backed mercenaries. They are now in full control of Al Juba Directorate, the last area held by militias south of the strategic city of Marib. Just an hour ago, we're joined by Yemeni activist and political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhati, who told us about the importance of liberating Marib for the Yemenis.
All oil fields, most of the oil fields and gas fields of Yemen, which actually used to be 85% of Yemeni budget, is in Marib. That's why if Yemeni army and air forces in Sana'a controlled it, this means that actually will be a huge step in the war against Saudi Arabia. And as well, with Marib City, they will actually have liberated all the north of Yemen. And I'm sure that there are like some Saudi media and sometimes on Twitter and social media like Facebook, some Saudis always try to send the message that if Sana'a forces reach the oil field and gas field, that maybe Saudi gonna bomb them or their mercenary will burn this field. But Yemeni forces have actually sent a clear message to Saudi Arabia that we have actually targeted many oil fields in Saudi Arabia, like in Baqiq and Quraysh, and as well the oil pipeline linked the Gulf of Persia and as well with the Red Sea north of Saudi Arabia. This means that if Saudi will do any mistake or a stupid step to target this oil field, this means that Yemeni army actually is capable to target all Saudi main oil infrastructure.
In the meantime, Yemen's Supreme Political Council has condemned the UN's inaction regarding the Saudi crimes in the country. It's urged the world body to end its support for the former government of Abdul Rabu Mansour Hadi, saying it does not represent the interests of the Yemeni people. Abdul Latif Al-Washad reports from Sana'a.
President of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, has sent a stern message to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, slamming the world body's inaction regarding Saudi Arabia's bloody war on Yemen.
Unfortunately, Saudi money has weakened the role of the United Nations in Yemen and has changed the world body's political position. The United Nations' primary concern should be the humanitarian situation in Yemen, but it has failed to consider that.
In the message sent to Antonio Guterres on United Nations Day, Mashat called on the UN to stop manipulating the facts in Yemen for political ends. He said the world body has effectively covered up for Saudis during 7 years of war under blockade. He added that the UN failure to renew the mandate of the Human Rights Council's group of eminent experts is yet another proof of how Saudis are bribing their way through the world body.
It was not so much a message of congratulation as it was a message of blame for the UN's negative role regarding what the Yemeni people have been subjected to over the past 7 years. It's a clear message that the UN must play its role and that the international community has failed morally in Yemen. We are ready to support the continued work of the United Nations and its humanitarian organizations and facilitate their operations inside Yemen, but on the condition that the United Nations protects the Yemeni people and stops Saudi violations.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people, including women and the children, and has pushed the country to the brink of famine.
Yemenis say the United Nations continues to apply double standards when dealing with the ongoing Saudi crimes against millions of Yemenis. They believe that the Yemeni army's operations are legitimate as it is defending the sovereignty of Yemen, which is the only way forward to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Well, let's take a look at Sudan. The military leader there is seeking to ease concerns a day after another coup d'etat in that country. The top general saying that the transitional government was overthrown to avoid a civil war. An oppressor, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, denied that a military takeover constituted a coup d'etat and pledged a transition to a civilian government. He accused political forces of incitement against the armed forces. He added that ousted Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok was in good health and would return home when the crisis is over. The general also vowed to scrap a state of emergency as soon as institutions are in place. On Monday, the armed forces arrested Hamdok and several other cabinet ministers, and that prompted protests in which at least seven people got killed. The coup has drawn global condemnation. A high-level meeting of Afghanistan's neighbors in Tehran has been set for this Wednesday. Iran saying that the gathering aims to send a unified message of support for the Afghan people.
The message from Tehran's meeting tomorrow is that the people of Afghanistan will only accept a government that reflects their will and represents their ethnic makeup. We are hoping to witness an inclusive mechanism in Afghanistan with help from all the countries involved and away from foreign interference.
Well, the official says that participants in the Tehran meeting will also send a message that Afghanistan should not become a hotbed for terrorism, extremism, and violence. He says it's unacceptable for Afghanistan to backtrack in security, social, and political areas. The spokesman also highlighted the protection of the people in Afghanistan and their rights as a top priority. Neighbors of Afghanistan plus Russia will get together in Tehran's peace conference. UN Director General Antonio Guterres will also deliver an online speech at the event. Time now for the news review section. Now, reactions continue to pour in to last week's drone attack on a major U.S. military base in southern Syria. The strike hit Al-Tanf base near the Syrian border with Iraq and Jordan. A U.S. official confirmed the coordinated attack, saying that no American troop stationed in the outpost has been injured or killed. Pro-resistance groups in the region saying that the attack was in retaliation for an Israeli strike on the Syrian city of Palmyra, which killed one Syrian soldier and wounded three others. Al-Tanf base is located in an area controlled by militants fighting the Syrian government. The U.S.'s military forces in Syria's northeast and southeast without any authorization from the Damascus government. Now, to get some insight on that, I'll be joined by Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies in Damascus. Also, Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert, is joining us out of Madison. Well, good to have you both, gentlemen, with us. Now, let me ask Tim. You know, there are some people who argue that this attack on Al-Tanf base is regarded as an attack on U.S. and Israeli interests. Let's have your comment on that.
Well, Al-Tanf certainly is a U.S. base, and its position on the border of Syria with both Jordan and Iraq, and if you notice, most of the other U.S.-based positioning is along the Iraqi border, with the exception of Al-Bukamal, which is regularly attacked by from various sides. So I think it's very important for U.S. strategy that they actually are trying to prevent coordination and cooperation between Syria and Iraq and Iran, of course. Now, that includes the coordination of attacks on Syria. Apparently, Israeli planes overflew Al-Tanf for their latest missile strikes. In the past, they've been overflying Lebanon. And so this is seen as a coordinated effort. I might add here that the Qassad or SDF militia, that is another U.S. proxy in eastern Syria, has been used, I've been told recently, to ferry Daesh fighters, ISIS fighters, down towards Deir ez-Zor, down through the desert where they've been carrying out attacks on the Syrian army. So you have a coordinated whole effort, really, involving the US, the Israelis, the remnants of ISIS that still exist there, and Qassad, or the SDF there. So from the Syrian point of view, you have the Syrian army, which is still positioned along eastern Syria, but also some informal resistance groups in eastern Syria that resent their domination by this this coordinated militia.
Okay. And Kevin, what's the U.S. exactly doing in Syria? Because we had former President Trump saying that we have taken care of Daesh, so we've done enough. Let others take care of the rest of them. And but later on, he said he let the cat out of the bag. He said we are there to secure the oil.
Yeah, Trump, of course, he blurts out all sorts of things. And I think there was perhaps some truth in his claim that they're, quote unquote, securing the oil, meaning working with corrupt forces in the region to steal Syria's oil, sell it on black markets. There's been a looting of Syria's oil. These pipelines have gone through Kurdistan and Turkey, and Israel has played a big role in this looting of Syria. And there's also the strategic element here where the Israeli tail regularly wags the U.S. dog, and in this case, the Israeli problem with its neighbors ends up becoming an American problem because of the Zionist control of American media and finance, giving the Zionists so much power in the United States that they essentially run U.S. Mideast policy. Everything the U.S. has been doing since the 9/11 false flag has been primarily based on aiding Israel's perceived geostrategic interests in endlessly expanding and destabilizing its neighbors. And that's, I think, the major part of what's going on here. As James Petras, the great sociologist, has written and documented at length, these wars are not really about American oil interests. They're really about Israeli geostrategic interests. And so it's no surprise that the U.S. forces invading Syria illegally, occupying Syria illegally, committing the supreme war crime of aggression, thereby setting themselves up to be executed right up to the very top of the chain of command, Joe Biden. They all deserve to be executed for the supreme war crime of aggression. But they're not even doing this for U.S. interests. They're doing this on behalf of the Zionist state of Israel that dominates American policy. And this is a scandal. If the American people really understood what's going on, they would rise up in outrage.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies in Damascus, and Kevin Barrett, author, Middle East expert in medicine. Moving on, in Iran, the number of coronavirus deaths and infections is witnessing a downward trend amid a widespread vaccination campaign. Health Ministry has registered 156 deaths in the past day, and that figure pushes the tally to around 125,000. Health officials also reported over 9,000 new cases in the same period. The overall caseload now standing at 5.8 million. Iran has administered some 82 million doses of vaccines, with nearly 31 million people fully vaccinated. Authorities have warned of another surge in the cases next month, though. President Raisi has emphasized the need for preemptive measures to prevent the sixth wave of the pandemic. Chinese authorities have placed 4 million people in the northwestern city of Lanzhou under lockdown amid a surge in COVID cases in some parts of the country. Residents are not allowed to leave home except for procuring essential supplies or medical treatment. Authorities say they will strictly monitor the new curve. And the restrictions came after a Chinese mainland reported 29 new domestic infections, 6 of them in Lanzhou, provincial capital of Gansu. The province has already enforced COVID-19 circuit breaker measures, limiting access to tourist sites. China has confirmed more than 100 new cases in the past week. The uptick is blamed on the Delta variant and a group of domestic tourists. China's total cases stand at nearly 97,000. There are also 4,600 deaths. Elsewhere in the world, there's been a sudden influx of new COVID cases in Russia recently, reporting a new all-time high for data fatalities. Russia is now struggling to bend the curve with lockdown measures. Just in the past day, more than 1,100 Russians died of the respiratory disease. And that's the seventh consecutive day that Russia is reporting more than 1,000 fatalities. The overall death toll there now hovering around 230,000. With an additional 36,000 daily infections, total caseload in Russia is nearing 8.2 million. The country will go into a nationwide workplace shutdown in the first week of November. Meantime, the situation is somber in neighboring Ukraine that's registering a record daily high of more than 730 deaths. So far, nearly 65,000 deaths and 2.8 million cases have been reported there. With the number of COVID deaths now nearing 5 million globally, an international health monitor says that the world has evidently failed in its response to the pandemic.
If the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic was defined by a collective failure to take preparedness seriously and act rapidly on the basis of science, the second has been marked by profound inequalities and the failure of leaders to understand our interconnectedness and act accordingly.
According to the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board, the worldwide health emergency system needs fundamental reform. It says the pandemic has exposed just how unequal, divided, and unaccountable today's world is. The board is an independent body established by the World Health Organization and the World Bank. The WHO has been calling for vaccines to be distributed more equitably across the globe. But with rich countries pursuing a me-first approach and encouraging third-dose booster shots for their own citizens, many poor nations are still struggling to get their first doses. Tensions brewing on the streets of Lima, Peru's capital, while the Congress there is delaying a confidence vote on President Pedro Castillo's new cabinet. And that has prompted an outpouring of public anger. Castillo's supporters faced off with riot police who used water cannon to disperse the crowd. Congress is led by the opposition, and it's now pushing back the confidence vote to mourn the death of a lawmaker. But the president's supporters are worried this will prolong uncertainty over the makeup of the new cabinet. Castillo has been in office for less than 3 months, and this is the second time that he's nominating a cabinet. Under Peruvian laws, Congress must confirm or reject a new cabinet just weeks after its nomination. Another stark warning by the UN ahead of crunch climate talks in Glasgow. The world body says the planet could witness a rise of 2.7 degrees Celsius temperature this century, despite commitments to cutting greenhouse gas emissions. The UN World Meteorological Organization says that greenhouse gas concentrations hit a record last year and that the world is way off track in capping rising temperatures. The UN's Environment Program also says the efforts by each country will only cut emission levels to around 7.5% by 2030. A 55% cut is needed to limit global temperature below 1.5 degrees Celsius. China, the United States, India, and the EU account for over 50% of the world's carbon emissions. In August, the UN Summit report outlined that human-induced climate change is affecting weather and climate extremes across the globe. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Nearly 700 European firms have financial ties worth $255 billion with businesses actively involved in Israeli settlements, according to a new civil society report. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Boxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Report Reveals European Firms Have More Than $255 Billion Entwined in Illegal Israeli Settlements. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Nearly 700 European firms have financial ties worth $255 billion with businesses actively involved in Israeli settlements, according to a new civil society report. The Don't Buy Into Occupation, or DBIO, coalition is a joint project between 25 Palestinian and European non-governmental organizations investigating the business connections between companies operating in illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, OPT, and European financial institutions. The coalition's latest research found 672 European financial institutions had relationships with 50 businesses participating in the Zionist regime settlement economy. Between 2018 and May 2021, major European firms provided loans and underwritings amounting to $114 billion to these businesses while investing $141 billion. The involvement of these corporations with the settlements through investments, banking loans, resource extraction, infrastructure contracts, and equipment and product supply agreements provides them with indispensable economic oxygen they require to grow and thrive. Michael Link, UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967, wrote in the report. The DBIO coalition found that the top 10 creditors collectively gave $77.81 billion to businesses involved in the illegal Israeli settlements. These firms are BNP Paribas, Deutsche Bank, HSBC, Barclays, Societe Generale, Santander, ING Group, Commerzbank, UniCredit, and Credit Agricole. And the 10 investors, Deutsche Bank, Credit Agricole, Government Pension Fund Global, GPFG, Investor AB, BPCE Group, Allianz, Swedbank, Legal and General, AB Industrialization, and Alecta contributed $67.22 billion. The coalition reached out to 138 firms as well as three corporations highlighted in the report and additional businesses the coalition found to be heavily involved in the settlement economy. Booking.com, BNP Paribas, and Heidelberg Cement and 21 financial institutions responded to the report's results. Replies varied, with some banks wanting to set up meetings to further discuss the findings, while other institutions said they have already investigated human rights concerns with their business partners. the report's authors declined to disclose with which institutions they are meeting, but DBIO said they plan to publish updates in the future. Some of them claim they did their human rights due diligence, but still decided to be involved in a settlement enterprise, which is quite against any of the suggestions or analysis of human rights experts. Dr. Anna Khadir, a legal researcher at Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights organization and one of the report's co-drafters, told Min Press News. Other institutions said any ties to illegal Israeli settlements are not within their sphere of decision-making because settlements are legal under Israeli law. While they are warranted by the Zionist regime, settlements are illegal under international law. So we still have a lot of work to do to explain how the settlement enterprise actually works and how much it is connected to the Israeli economy, while the Zionist regime itself will not provide enough information or transparency about those links with the illegal settlement enterprise, Khadir said. The Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement has experienced incredible mobilization recently. American ice cream maker Ben & Jerry's made headlines over the summer after announcing it will stop selling in illegal Israeli settlements. Two pension companies named in the DBIO report also recently divested from companies linked to the settlement enterprise. In July, Communal Landscape, KLP, Norway's biggest pension firm, divested from 16 companies involved in illegal Israeli settlements. In KLP's assessment, there is an unacceptable risk that excluded the companies are contributing to the abuse of human rights in situations of war and conflict through their links with the Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, KLP said in a statement regarding their decision. The businesses from which KLP divested from are Ashram Group Ltd, Electra Ltd, Alstom SA, Bank Hapolim, Bank Lumi, Israel Discount Bank, First International Bank Israel, etc. In September, the Norwegian pension company GPFG announced it will stop working with Ilco Ltd, Ashram Group Ltd and Electra Ltd because of their activities in the illegal Israeli settlements. In the last decade, Deutsche Bank, HSBC and Barclays have also divested from some companies involved in the settlements.
Simple question.
Is the UK's ambulance service in crisis? Recent news reports have revealed there are now too few crews to keep up with demand and the close to 1 million calls they get every month. Despite limited resources, the ambulance crews are doing their best, but they know there is little prospect of a reduction in the massive pressures they have to endure every day.
Dealing with the increased number of calls caused by COVID has made the problems worse. However, the underlying issues are related to a rise in general demand for ambulance services and a fall in those currently employed to deliver it. Thousands of paramedics have left the ambulance service, leading to a shortfall that those who remain must try and cope with. The impact is clear and concerning. The service struggles to cope with demand, and as a result, ambulance service crews are regularly missing the time targets set for them. This in turn is increasing the level of stress on those who remain in the ambulance service. Indeed, stress-related illness amongst paramedics has gone up, with reported cases in the service increasing by 71% during the coronavirus pandemic.
How would it feel to wait for hours for an ambulance to arrive? And are the public concerned about a potentially growing shortage of ambulance crews for the winter ahead? Simple questions with important answers. Now let's start with this. Over the last 2 years, thousands of paramedics have left the service. How does the public feel about that? We put it to them outside this major hospital in London. Here's what they told us.
I feel that it takes a toll and effect on people because people are needing help. They've got no source of transport, no support, nothing to get to a hospital, you know. And some people live by themselves or are single parents, whatever. They've got no one to help them there.
They're understaffed and they should be properly funded, and there should be the money's there, so there should be the right funding for the right sectors. And if the money's there, then where's this money going? It's not to the right places.
Well, I think the government would need to do something about that because there are a lot of people that do need healthcare services. And I think they need to recruit more drivers.
I think that's bad because like ambulances are very important, and like if it takes long, it can affect someone's chance of surviving. So that's not a good thing.
It makes me feel quite upset. I think that we need those people, that those are the most vital people in life, basically, in every country. So, yeah, like we definitely need to get those numbers back so people can fill in those positions.
Well, I think I can understand it. I'm surprised that they've been able to cope as well as they seem to have, you know, over the past 18 months. It seems to be just relentless and quite thankless, too. You know, you hear about aggression towards ambulance drivers and that, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's probably it is sad, but I guess it's all the pressure that's on them. You know, dealing with social issues as well as the
concerned for sure because of safety. If we need service, what do we do? How do we go about it and get treated? You know, and so on. So yeah. But also, I'm a bit more concerned about the level of violence towards them, too.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard good things. I don't really know much about it. It seems pretty easy to get services. I know getting vaccinated was kind of difficult for some of my friends, which was, like, it was a priority for them to get vaccinated. So I think that might have been difficult. But, yeah, I guess other than that, I've been able to access all the services I need. So, and as someone who's not actually...
A bit concerning, to be honest. I only had one personal experience where I've had to call an ambulance in the UK, and I did find that the wait time was already quite long, so I think if there's any further reductions, it's just going to get worse and worse, and people are going to be waiting longer and longer. It's hard enough, as is, I think, with London, especially because of the traffic. It's hard to get ambulance to places they need to be with enough of them on the road, let alone if they remove some of them. So
it's scary because, like, we need the NHS. Like, we need... A lot of people can't afford privatised healthcare, so, like, having fewer ambulances means, like, probably more deaths, more, like, things that could have been prevented if we did have the right amount of funding and for the NHS and the ambulance.
The fact that there are fewer ambulance staff, I mean, I haven't ever needed any ambulance resource, but my first instinct is that it sounds like it's something that's critical.
Well, I used to be a care worker myself, so... That wasn't for the NHS, though. I have worked for the NHS since. but the main issue is really low rates of play, long hours, not very much encouragement, and a little, and a climate that whatever you do, it's going to be wrong.
I need to see the data to say if it's right or not, because I'm not entirely sure, but I do know that the waiting time is longer to just get to the GP, that's for sure. At the same time, you know, if we want to have more staff, then we need to allocate more resources to that. And then, well, the funding obviously will have to change, so we need to cut it from somewhere else or collect more in taxes. So that's, you know.
Why can't the NHS retain enough staff to run the ambulance service? Here's the public's opinion.
Many, many things, many reasons come to mind. You know, pay, level of working conditions, level of pay, treatment by others, the attacks on people. The list goes on.
I'd say it would be a combination of things, like probably to do with pay, maybe something to do with Brexit as well, and probably just a whole different range of things.
I think probably burnout. You know, I think the best of times, it's quite a difficult job to. You know, it's not like going to your job and then just going home again. I think, you know, they're in there for long hours and they see a lot of difficult situations. And it's probably very hard for them to switch off. So if they're being overstretched, I imagine mentally it would be very difficult to cope. Apart from any of the other, you know, aggressions that they might face during the job, you know, which would discourage them.
I guess because it's like an extremely under strain situation, and people aren't probably don't feel especially valued.
I mean, I've been in the Canadian system since I was born, so I've never had any health issues either, so I can't really speak to that. But I think it's so far it's been quicker to get tests and prescriptions that I need here than it has been at home. That's something, I guess, yeah.
I think especially in the past year with coronavirus, they've been under a lot of stress. It's been very difficult for a lot of those staff. It might be that some of them can't take the pressure of it anymore and they're just not getting the same treatment and respect that they should be getting. Probably looking for a different job.
I feel like it could be a danger, but I feel like it could be, like, easy sword as well. Because, like, obviously with corona, it was affected a lot, but I feel like we can bounce back from that. So I feel like it could get back to a good position.
I think it's the government. I feel like the funding for the NHS, including the ambulance and like everything like that, the government is cutting down on, and we need to like increase the budget and for the NHS.
I can only assume the recent 2 years where I think people have been working under such stress without recovery time, with a lot of anxiety, and I get the impression that there's not very much resource and there's not very much support for them.
There's a lot of competition for jobs out there, pay's not very good, but the NHS costs the government a great deal of money, and I would imagine the government is struggling to find enough money to pay for all that, so it's in the same problem as a lot of employers have, which is finding enough money to pay wages that will attract people and get them to stay. It's not an easy problem to solve.
I'm not sure if it's less and less in people wanting to work for there. I think the demand is just higher. I think there's more and more people who need it, and I think the supply just doesn't meet it of the work stuff, but maybe there is less of people working as well. But for sure, I think there's just more people like coming to the UK in general.
It's stress from probably overwork and the amount of work that's expected from them and you know, trying to keep a brave face for the people that they're dealing with. Yeah.
I think there's something secretly going on that the public don't know about. As we all know, government always hides a bit more than what we know. Obviously, they're not getting paid enough for the great work they do. But I can't say I know, but you can tell from an outside point of view that something is not going right.
Yeah, stress, underfunding, severe underfunding, cuts. And it's one thing when the NHS is not properly funded, and another when Boris and his mates can just get their pay rises, and then so obviously the money's there because you know it's there. You can see where the money's going, and it's not going in the right places. So I imagine that if they don't feel appreciated, what was it last year? People were on their doorsteps clapping for them. It's like that's all well and good, but it's just gestures at the end of the day, and they should be properly paid. and maybe then they wouldn't be having to leave.
Possibly because everybody wants to be safe and stay alive for their families. It might have something to do with the wages that they're being paid. Maybe the government needs to think about increasing their wages, and you know, that might possibly retain the staff.
Yeah, probably stress and pay and everything as well. Maybe abroad they might get better money and things like that, possibly.
We're heading into winter, and ambulance professionals are warning that things will get worse.
Yeah, again, it's very concerning if that is the case, where there's more and more people leaving the profession and there's not enough people to actually backfill them. Yeah, it's naturally concerning to anybody, really, and I think whoever are the policy makers need to do something about it to address that issue and be a little bit more transparent about it.
Regarding to your question, I just think that NHS did a lot, and a lot for our country, or from all the citizens of this country, and for everyone. They looking after everyone like we are their own family, and also they maybe they are fed up a little bit like everyone, because if they are working too much and their work is not appreciated, obviously they are fed like a bit tired, just keeping working hard and maintain our healthy and to protect us. So it's like they're doing a really hard job for us to keeping everybody safe. And I think like everyone, they, before of their duties and their job, they are human exactly like us. So I think they are a bit tired at the moment because they was working too hard to keeping everybody safe.
I mean, it's a little bit concerning. I know that people who work, paramedics and people who work in that field are extremely valuable, and I think it's really important to pay them what they deserve, make sure that they have good working conditions, and do whatever's necessary to make sure that those services are accessible and available to people.
It's going to take a toll, and it's going to get scary. As you know, we're in a pandemic, and the crime is getting worse. Even the police, not just the ambulance, the police, they don't answer for hours. Imagine you're calling the police asking for help, you're going to get stabbed or anything, and they don't answer. You're on a one-hour hold, and then no one comes. Just like the ambulance. Your life is gone within seconds.
Oh, it's terrible. It's really horrible because, I mean, we live in, like, a progressive country where we should have these services already available, and the fact that they're not, shows you something about the current state of this country.
That would be really devastating to know that, you know, on the other line of the telephone, if you call 999, there's nobody to pick up the call. You know, we do need that support, and we do pay our taxes for these services, so they should be made available.
I think there needs to be better methods of getting the ambulances to where they need to be, whether it's certain response roads or things like that that allow emergency services to access routes that cars and general traffic might not be able to use, or something along those lines that just allows them to get where they need to be faster.
I just feel like totally just hurt, just like thinking that it didn't have to be like this, and just wishing that there would be someone there to come to the scene as soon as possible, because a lot of times I know many people that's been in a position where they had to wait loads of minutes for ambulance to come. So yeah, just it's like not everyone has a car to get to the ambulance as well, so it's kind of hard. You might have to find different ways of transportation, and with the stress of having to deal with whoever you're dealing with at the moment, that's kind of hard to do. So yeah.
Well, it's a very unpleasant thought. I mean, I actually needed to call an ambulance just 2 days ago, and I was incredibly lucky, I suppose, because there was somebody there within 25 minutes. And that's when things are sort of quite difficult at the moment. It would be nice to think that there'll be a way to sort of supplement the service that they're providing at the moment. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, my case wasn't particularly life-threatening, but I imagine if you're lying there with a broken leg or something, I mean, that's going to be a very difficult situation for people to deal with.
It'd be awful, to be in that position. But, it's something that needs to be addressed along with all the other social care issues that needs to be addressed by government. Yeah.
It does, because it's putting family, loved ones at risk. When you are in need, nobody is coming.
Let's look at the facts, and the statistics tell a story of concern. Since 2018, the number of paramedics has fallen from 32,200 to 28,700. Largely because of this, emergency call-out waiting times are on average 9 minutes instead of the target 7 minutes. Less serious call-out times are 46 minutes versus the 18-minute target. And non-emergency waiting times can reach as much as 7.5 hours, with one patient held in an ambulance in the west of England for 11 hours and 46 minutes. How would people here in London feel if they had to wait for up to 7.5 hours for an ambulance to arrive?
It's happened to me so many times, I don't call ambulance again. Really? I just get a taxi.
I'd be really like upset if I had to wait that length of time for an ambulance. Like, I have had to wait long for, like, I've called an ambulance before and had to wait 4 hours, so, but that wasn't an emergency one, so.
That's inexcusable, really. And there was another case I heard about the other day, and it was even longer than that, and the person died as a result of it. I think it was a heart problem. By the time they actually got to where they needed to get him, it was too late. So I think for a country that has the wealth of Britain, this shouldn't be happening. I think there must be a way around it. I mean, I lived in Germany for many years. I don't think in Germany this would be acceptable. It just, they would find a way to cope with whatever shortages that they have.
Be angry and, you know, and just worrying about your own health and, knowing that help isn't, usually you associate the ambulance should be with you in 7 to 8 minutes, but are those days gone? That's, be very angry,
I feel sad because I live by myself. I feel sad because you feel like no one cares about you and you feel like the only people that would care about you, the ambulance, unfortunately they can't be there.
It's terrible, obviously. If you have an illness or a problem, if you're sick, you need to go to the hospital, then, it's not like in the States where you'd have to pay to go for the ambulance. You know, like, I hear a lot of stories when they say if you're pregnant in the States, then you have to pay for the ambulance, so people would rather pay for an Uber. It's like, imagine having to pay for a taxi to take you to the ambulance when the ambulance should be provided there, because you pay all this tax money, and where's it going?
Really scared, because like I said, some families and some individuals are home alone. They have no families, you know, so they rely on the public health service to be there for them in times of emergencies, really.
What's the public's message to government about the growing emergency in the ambulance services?
I think from a government point of view, the NHS is complex because of its size. We often talk about the inefficiencies, but it's more than that. It seems many of them are underpaid. That has to be resolved. I think they need a lot of softer support. They need their own therapies and coaching to help them with the traumas that they've been through. And as a member of the public, I've no idea.
I think supporting them as a government, listening to their complaints or comments about working conditions, hours that they work, support in terms of infrastructure that they need, and at least considering it before kind of going ahead with any sort of political agenda.
Well, I'd like them to say step up and, just get with it. You know, look at what's happening out and don't sort of hide behind it. Don't be shy about it. You know, look at this, what's going on, and put some investment behind it.
Our message is to government is to basically come together and find different ways how you can promote the job for the ambulance drivers, and just basically use everything you have to try and make people want to come and work for the ambulance, and don't that respect them as well.
So look at their hours, look at the work that they do, the work that's expected of them, and offer them more flexible hours, more training, and more just more help generally.
The job is very stressful and is well underpaid, so the government needs to pay people well and make sure that the working environment is safe. Also the people need to relax about people who work in the NHS, because when they see something on social, they take it too seriously. Their job is stressful, people need to de-stress, and people do things differently.
Well, I think they may find that people start becoming more active in their unhappiness with the situation. You know, I'm not sort of suggesting that people become more aggressive, but I think some kind of popular action is probably going to happen sooner or later, because people are being pressed in so many areas, and this is possibly going to be, you know, just the final straw for a lot of people.
Recruit more staffs, pay good wages, and hopefully the staff members would stay.
My message to the government is fix up. Start caring about people, because you really care about your money. That's it, you care about how your family is and everything like that, and your government, whatever. But how about the civilians? Because we make up the country, we make up the world. You know, they care about themselves until one day it's going to fall back on them. You know, that's my message to the government, is fix up.
There is no doubt the COVID-19 pandemic has contributed to the underlying issues which the ambulance service has been dealing with. Continued decline in the number of paramedics available. It is also clear that the psychological effects on those who remain continue to cause increasing concern. There have even been reports of suicide in the service.
The NHS is often described as a crowning achievement of the British state. For decades, it has served the public all year round. But with falling numbers of paramedics and almost a million calls a month, demand simply exceeds supply. As we head towards a potentially troubling winter rise in those calls, the evidence suggests that the UK Emergency Ambulance Service is on the verge of declaring an emergency of its own.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.